What did the islanders eat, and how many of them were there? At the time of European arrival, they subsisted mainly as farmers, growing sweet potatoes, yams, taro, bananas, and sugarcane, plus chickens as their sole domestic animal. Fish and shellfish made a smaller contribution to the diet than on most other Polynesian islands. The result was a high-carbohydrate diet, exacerbated by the islanders compensating for Easter's limited sources of fresh water by drinking sugarcane juice. No dentist would be surprised to learn that the islanders ended up with the highest incidence of tooth decay of any known prehistoric people. Easter's population at its peak has been estimated by methods such as counting the number of house foundations, or by estimating the numbers of chiefs and their followers from the numbers of platforms or erected statues. The resulting estimates range from a low of 6,000 to a high of 30,000 people, which works out to an average of 90 to 450 people per square mile. My own opinion is that the higher estimates are more likely to be correct, in part because those estimates are by the archaeologists with the most extensive recent experience of surveying Easter. In addition, the earliest reliable estimate of Easter's population, 2,000 people, was made by missionaries who took up residence in 1864, just after an epidemic of smallpox had killed off most of the population. And that was after the kidnapping of about 1,500 islanders by Peruvian slave ships in 1862-63, after two previous documented smallpox epidemics dating back to 1836, after the virtual certainty of other undocumented epidemics introduced by regular European visitors from 1770 onwards, and after a steep population crash that began in the 1600s. The same ship that brought the third smallpox epidemic to Easter went on to the Marquesas, where the resulting epidemic killed 7/8 of the population. For these reasons, it seems to me impossible that the 1864 post-smallpox population of 2,000 people represented the residue of only 6,000 to 8,000 people. Having seen the evidence for intensive prehistoric agriculture on Easter, I find estimates of 15,000 or more people unsurprising. That evidence for agricultural intensification is of several types. One type consists of stone-lined pits 5 to 8 feet in diameter and up to 4 feet deep that were used as composting pits in which to grow crops, and possibly also as vegetable fermentation pits. Another type of evidence is a pair of stone dams built across the bed of the intermittent stream draining the southeastern slope of Mount Tarawaca in order to divert water onto broad stone platforms. That water diversion system resembles systems for irrigated taro production elsewhere in Polynesia. Still further evidence for agricultural intensification is numerous stone chicken houses, mostly up to 20 feet long, 10 feet wide, and 6 feet high, with a small entrance near the ground for chickens to run in and out, and with an adjacent yard ringed by a stone wall to prevent the precious chickens from running away or being stolen. But the most widespread method adopted to increase agricultural output involved various uses of lava rocks. Large boulders were stacked as windbreaks to protect plants from being dried out by Easter's frequent strong winds. Smaller boulders were piled to create protected above-ground or sunken gardens for growing bananas and also for starting seedlings to be transplanted after they had grown larger. Extensive areas of ground were partly covered by rocks placed at close intervals on the surface, such that plants could come up between the rocks. Other large areas were modified by so-called lithic mulches, which means partly filling the soil with rocks down to a depth of a foot, either by carrying rocks from nearby outcrops or else by digging down to and breaking up bedrock. Depressions for planting taro were excavated into natural gravel fields. All of these rock windbreaks and gardens involved a huge effort to construct, because they required moving millions or even billions of rocks. Why did farmers go to all that effort? The answer has to do with Easter's windy, dry, cool climate. Rocks make the soil moister by covering it, reducing evaporative water loss due to sun and wind, and replacing a hard surface crust of soil that would otherwise promote rain runoff. Rocks absorb solar heat during the day and release it at night. They protect soil against being eroded by splashing rain droplets. Dark rocks on lighter soil warm up the soil by absorbing more solar heat, and rocks may also serve as slow, time-release fertilizer pills by containing needed minerals that gradually become leached out into the soil. Those are enormous advantages. As elsewhere in Polynesia, traditional Easter Island society was divided into chiefs and commoners. To archaeologists today, the difference is obvious from remains of the different houses of the two groups.
Chiefs and members of the elite lived in houses termed harepaenga, in the shape of a long and slender upside-down canoe, typically around 40 feet long, not more than 10 feet wide, and curved at the ends. Harepaenga were built in the 200-yard broad coastal strip, 6 to 10 of them at each major site, immediately inland of the site's platform bearing the statues.
Houses of commoners were relegated to locations further inland, were smaller, and were associated each with its own chicken house, oven, stone garden circle, and garbage pit. Both oral traditions preserved by the islanders and archaeological surveys suggest that Easter's land surface was divided into 11 or 12 territories, each belonging to one clan or lineage group, and each starting from the seacoast and extending inland, as if Easter were a pie cut into wedges. Each territory had its own chief and its own major ceremonial platform supporting statues. That division into radially sliced territories is typical for Polynesian islands elsewhere in the Pacific. What is unusual in that respect about Easter is that those competing clan territories were also integrated religiously, and to some extent economically and politically, under the leadership of one paramount chief. What might account for Easter's integration? It turns out that different territories were endowed with different valuable resources. The most obvious example is that Tongariki territory contained Ranuraraku Crater, the island's only source of the best stone for carving statues. The red stone cylinders on top of some statues all came from Hanga Pukura territory. Venapu and Hanga Pukura territories controlled the three major quarries of obsidian, the fine-grained volcanic stone used for making sharp tools. Other resources, such as timber, coral for making files, red ochre, and paper mulberry trees, the source of bark pounded into tapa cloth, were also unevenly distributed. The clearest archaeological evidence for some degree of integration among the competing clan territories is that stone statues and their red cylinders ended up on platforms in all 11 or 12 territories distributed all over the island. Hence, a clan living at a distance from the quarries would have needed permission from several clans to transport statues and cylinders across the latter's territories. At first, that seems only natural to us. We take it for granted that resources from one coast are routinely transported long distances to other coasts. But we forget how complicated it has usually been throughout history for one territory to negotiate access to another territory's resources. We now return to the subject that everyone thinks of first at the mention of Easter Island, its giant stone statues termed moai, and the stone platforms termed ahu on which they stood. About 300 ahu have been identified, of which about 113 did bear moai, and 25 of them were especially large and elaborate. Each of the island's dozen territories had between 1 and 5 of those large ahu. The ahu is a rectangular platform made of rubble fill, held in place by 4 stone retaining walls of gray basalt. The ahu are up to 13 feet high, and many are extended by lateral wings to a width of up to 500 feet. Hence, an ahu's total weight, from about 300 tons up to more than 9,000 tons, dwarfs that of the statues that it supports. In back of an ahu are crematoria containing the remains of thousands of bodies. In that practice of cremation, Easter was unique in Polynesia, where bodies were otherwise just buried. Today, the ahu are dark gray, but originally, they were a much more colorful white, yellow, and red. The facing slabs were encrusted with white coral, the stone of a freshly cut moai was yellow, and the moai's crown was red. As for the moai, which represent high-ranking ancestors, archaeologist Joanne Van Tilburg has inventoried a total of 887 carved, of which nearly half still remain in Ranuraraku Quarry, while most of those transported out of the quarry were erected on ahu. The average erected statue was 13 feet tall and weighed about 10 tons. We would, of course, love to know exactly when Easter Islanders erected their first statues and how styles and dimensions changed with time. Unfortunately, because stone cannot be radiocarbon dated, we are forced to rely on indirect dating methods. It seems clear, however, that later statues tended to be taller, though not necessarily heavier, and that the biggest Ahu underwent multiple rebuildings with time to become larger and more elaborate. The increase in statue size with time suggests competition between rival chiefs commissioning the statues to outdo each other. That conclusion also screams from an apparently late feature called Pukau, a cylinder of red scoria weighing up to 12 tons, mounted as a separate piece to rest on top of a Moai's flat head. We don't know for sure what the Pukau represented. Our best guess is a headdress of red bird's feathers prized throughout Polynesia and reserved for chiefs, or else a hat of feathers and tapa cloth. Given the widespread distribution over Polynesia of platforms and statues, why were only Easter Islanders the ones to go overboard? To make by far the largest investment of societal resources in building them, and to erect the biggest ones. At least four different factors cooperated to produce that outcome. First, Ranu Raraku tuff is the best stone in the Pacific for carving. Second, other Pacific Island societies devoted their energy, resources, and labor to inter-island trading, raiding, exploration, colonization, and emigration. But those competing outlets were foreclosed for Easter Islanders by their isolation. Third, Easter's gentle terrain and complementary resources in different territories led to some integration of the island, thereby letting clans all over the island obtain Ranu Raraku stone. Finally, as we shall see, building platforms and statues required feeding lots of people, a feat made possible by the food surpluses produced by elite-controlled upland plantations. How did all those Easter Islanders lacking cranes succeed in carving, transporting, and erecting those statues? Of course, we don't know for sure, but we can make informed guesses from oral traditions of the islanders themselves and from recent experimental tests of different transport methods. In Ranu Raraku Quarry, one can see incomplete statues still in the rock face and surrounded by narrow carving canals only about 2 feet wide. The most incomplete statues are nothing more than a block of stone roughly carved out of the rock, with the eventual face upwards and with the back still attached to the underlying cliff below by a long keel of rock. Next to be carved were the head, nose, and ears, followed by the arms, hands, and loincloth. At that stage, the keel connecting the statue's back to the cliff was chipped through, and transport of the statue out of its niche began. The still visible transport roads on which statues were moved from quarries follow contour lines to avoid the extra work of carrying statues up and down hills, and are up to 9 miles long. While the task may strike us as daunting, we know that many other prehistoric peoples transported very heavy stones. Modern scholars have tested their various theories of statue transport on Easter by actually moving statues. The method most convincing to me is Joanne Van Tilburg's suggestion that Easter Islanders modified the so-called canoe ladders that were widespread on Pacific Islands for transporting heavy wooden logs. The ladders consist of a pair of parallel wooden rails joined by fixed wooden crosspieces over which the log is dragged. In the New Guinea region, I have seen such ladders more than a mile long, extending from the coast hundreds of feet uphill to a forest clearing at which a huge tree was being hollowed out to make a canoe hull. Joanne enlisted modern Easter Islanders to put her theory to a test by building such a canoe ladder, mounting a statue prone on a wooden sled, attaching ropes to the sled, and hauling it over the ladder. She found that 50 to 70 people, working 5 hours per day and dragging the sled 5 yards at each pull, could transport an average-sized 12-ton statue 9 miles in a week. By extrapolation, transport of even big statues could have been accomplished by a team of 500 adults, which would have been just within the manpower capabilities of an Easter Island clan of 1 or 2,000 people. Easter Islanders told Thor Heyerdahl how their ancestors had erected statues on Ahu. and they erected a statue for him without a crane to prove their point. They began by building a gently sloping ramp of stones from the plaza up to the top of the front of the platform, and pulling the prone statue with its base end forwards up the ramp. Once the base had reached the platform, they levered the statue's head an inch or two upwards with logs, slipped stones under the head to support it, and continued to lever up the head and thereby to tilt the statue increasingly towards the vertical. The whole operation must have been enormously expensive of food resources. Archaeologists who first tried to calculate the food consumed overlooked the fact that the statue itself was a smaller part of the operation. Anahu outweighed its statues by a factor of about 20 times, and all that stone for the Ahu also had to be transported. Joanne Van Tilburg and her architect husband Jan did a rough calculation of the work on Easter. They concluded that given the number and size of Easter's Ahu and Moai, the work of constructing them added about 25% to the food requirements of Easter's population over the 300 peak years of construction. The statue operation required not only lots of food, but also lots of thick, long ropes made from fibrous tree bark, by which 50 to 500 people could drag statues weighing 10 to 90 tons, and also lots of big, strong trees to obtain all the timber needed for the sleds, canoe ladders, and levers. But the Easter Island seen by Roggeveen and subsequent European visitors was the most nearly treeless island in all of Polynesia. Where were the trees that provided the rope and the timber? Botanical surveys of plants living on Easter within the 20th century have identified only 48 native species, even the biggest of them hardly worthy of being called a tree, and the rest of them low ferns, grasses, sedges, and shrubs. However, several methods for recovering remains of vanished plants have shown within the last few decades that, for hundreds of thousands of years before human arrival and during the early days of human settlement, Easter was not at all a barren wasteland, but a subtropical forest of tall trees and woody bushes. The first such method to yield results was the technique of pollen analysis, or palynology, which involves boring out a column of sediment deposited in a swamp or pond. In such a column, the surface mud must have been deposited most recently, while more deeply buried mud represents more ancient deposits. The actual age of each layer in the deposit can be dated by radiocarbon methods. There remains the incredibly tedious task of examining tens of thousands of pollen grains in the column under a microscope, counting them, and then identifying the plant species producing each grain by comparison with modern pollen from known plant species. For Easter Island, the first bleary-eyed scientist to perform that task was a Swedish palynologist, Olof Selling, who examined cores collected from the swamps by Heyerdahl's 1955 expedition. He detected abundant pollen of an unidentified species of palm tree, of which Easter today has no native species. In 1977 and 1983, John Flenley collected many more sediment cores and again noticed abundant palm pollen. In 1983, he also obtained some fossil palm nuts that visiting French cave explorers had discovered that year, and he sent them to the world's leading palm expert for identification. The nuts turned out to be very similar to, but slightly larger than, those of the world's largest existing palm tree, the Chilean wine palm, which grows up to 65 feet tall and 3 feet in diameter. Subsequent visitors to Easter have found more evidence of the palm in the form of casts of its trunks buried in Mount Taravaca's lava, and casts of its root bundles, proving that the Easter palm's trunk reached diameters exceeding 7 feet. It dwarfed even the Chilean palm, and was, while it existed, the biggest palm in the world. Chileans prize their wine palm for several reasons, and Easter Islanders would have done so as well. As the name implies, the trunk yields a sweet sap that can be fermented to wine or boiled down to make honey or sugar. The nut's oily kernels are rated a delicacy. The fronds are ideal for fabricating into house thatching, baskets, mats, and boat sails. And, of course, the stout trunks would have served to transport and erect moai, and perhaps to make rafts. Flinley and Sarah King recognized pollen of five other now-extinct trees in the sediment cores. More recently, the French archaeologist Catherine Orliac has been sieving out 30,000 fragments of wood, burned to charcoal, from cores dug into Easter Island ovens and garbage heaps. She has identified about 16 other plant species, most of them trees related to or the same as trees still widespread in East Polynesia. Thus, Easter used to support a diverse forest. The person who pored through 6,433 bones of birds and other vertebrates from early middens at Anacana Beach was zooarchaeologist David Stedman. He proved that Easter, which today supports not a single species of native land bird, was formerly home to at least six of them. More impressive was Easter's prodigious total of at least 25 nesting seabird species, making it formerly the richest breeding site in all of Polynesia, and probably in the whole Pacific. The Anacana excavations that yielded those bird bones tell us much about the diet and lifestyle of Easter's first human settlers. Out of those 6,433 vertebrate bones identified, the most frequent ones, accounting for more than one-third of the total, proved to belong to the common dolphin, a porpoise weighing up to 165 pounds. The common dolphin generally lives out to sea. Hence, it must have been harpooned far offshore in big, seaworthy canoes built from tall trees. Fish bones also occur in the middens, but account there for only 23% of all bones, whereas elsewhere in Polynesia, they were 90% or more of all bones. That low contribution of fish was because there are few places to catch fish by net or handline in shallow water. For the same reason, the Easter diet was low in mollusks and sea urchins. To compensate, there were those abundant seabirds plus the land birds. Bird stew would have been seasoned with meat from large numbers of rats, which reached Easter as stowaways in the canoes of the Polynesian colonists. Easter is the sole known Polynesian island at whose archaeological sites rat bones outnumber fish bones. Other bones testify to the occasional availability of seals, sea turtles, and perhaps of large lizards. All those delicacies were cooked over firewood that can be identified as having come from Easter's subsequently vanished forests. The giant palm and all the other trees disappeared for half a dozen reasons that we can document or infer. Charcoal samples from ovens proved directly that trees were being burned for firewood. They were also being burned to cremate bodies. Trees were being cleared for gardens, because most of Easter's land surface, except at the highest elevations, ended up being used to grow crops. From the early midden abundance of bones of open-ocean porpoises and tuna, we infer that big trees were being felled to make seaworthy canoes. We infer that trees furnished timber and rope for transporting and erecting statues, and undoubtedly for a multitude of other purposes. Most radiocarbon dates on the palm nuts are before 1500. Suggesting that the palm became rare or extinct thereafter. Radiocarbon-dated charcoal samples from ovens and garbage pits show wood charcoal being replaced by herb and grass fuels after 1640, even at elite houses. This suggests that forest clearance began soon after human arrival and was virtually complete by the 1600s. The overall picture for Easter is the most extreme example of forest destruction in the Pacific, and among the most extreme in the world. The whole forest gone, and all of its tree species extinct. Immediate consequences for the islanders were losses of raw materials, losses of wild-caught foods, and decreased crop yields. Raw materials lost, or else available only in greatly decreased amounts, consisted of everything made from native plants and birds, including wood, rope, bark to manufacture bark cloth, and feathers. Lack of large timber and rope brought an end to the transport and erection of statues, and also to the construction of seagoing canoes. Lack of large timber also meant that people were without wood for fuel to keep themselves warm during Easter's winter nights of wind and driving rain at a temperature of 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Instead, after 1650, Easter's inhabitants were reduced to burning herbs, grasses, and sugarcane scraps and other crop wastes for fuel. there would have been fierce competition for the remaining woody shrubs among people trying to obtain thatching and small pieces of wood for houses, wood for implements, and bark cloth. Even funeral practices had to be changed. Cremation, which had required burning much wood per body, became impractical and yielded to mummification and bone burials. Most sources of wild food were lost. Without seagoing canoes, bones of porpoises virtually disappeared from Middens by 1500. Land birds disappeared completely, and seabirds were reduced to one-third of Easter's original species, confined to breeding on a few offshore islets. Palm nuts, Malay apples, and all other wild fruits dropped out of the diet. The shellfish consumed became smaller species, and smaller and many fewer individuals. The only wild food source whose availability remained unchanged was rats. In addition to those drastic decreases in wild food sources, crop yields also decreased, for several reasons. Deforestation led locally to soil erosion by rain and wind, as shown by huge increases in the quantities of soil-derived metal ions carried into swamp sediment cores. Other damages to soil included desiccation and nutrient leaching. Farmers found themselves without most of the wild plant leaves, fruit, and twigs that they had been using as compost. Those were the immediate consequences of deforestation and other human environmental impacts. The further consequences start with starvation, a population crash, and a descent into cannibalism. Surviving islanders' accounts of starvation are graphically confirmed by the proliferation of little statues called Moai Kavakava, depicting starving people with hollow cheeks and protruding ribs. Captain Cook, in 1774, described the islanders as small, lean, timid, and miserable. Numbers of house sites in the coastal lowlands, where almost everybody lived, declined by 70% from peak values around 1400 to 1600 to the 1700s, suggesting a corresponding decline in numbers of people. In place of their former sources of wild meat, islanders turned to the largest hitherto unused source available to them, humans, whose bones became common not only in proper burials, but also, cracked to extract the marrow, in late Easter Island garbage heaps. Oral traditions of the islanders are obsessed with cannibalism. The most inflammatory taunt that could be snarled at an enemy was, "The flesh of your mother sticks between my teeth." Easter's chiefs and priests had previously justified their elite status by claiming relationship to the gods and by promising to deliver prosperity and bountiful harvests. As their promises were being proved increasingly hollow, the power of the chiefs and priests was overthrown around 1680 by military leaders, and Easter's formerly complexly integrated society collapsed in an epidemic of civil war. What had failed in the twilight of Easter's Polynesian society was not only the old political ideology, but also the old religion, which became discarded along with the chief's power. Oral traditions record that the last Ahu and Moai were erected around 1620. Around 1680, rival clans switched from erecting statues to throwing down each other's statues. Thus, the collapse of Easter society followed swiftly upon the society's reaching its peak of population, monument construction, and environmental impact. The sad story of European impacts on Easter Islanders may be quickly summarized. After Captain Cook's brief sojourn in 1774, there was a steady trickle of European visitors. They must be assumed to have introduced European diseases, and thereby to have killed many islanders, though our first specific mention of such an epidemic is of smallpox around 1836. Blackbirding, the kidnapping of islanders to become laborers, began on Easter around 1805 and climaxed in 1862-63, when two dozen Peruvian ships abducted about 1,500 people, half of the surviving population, and sold them at auction to work in Peru's guano mines and other menial jobs. Most of those kidnapped died in captivity. Under international pressure, Peru repatriated a dozen surviving captives, who brought another smallpox epidemic to the island. By 1872, there were only 111 islanders left on Easter. European traders introduced sheep to Easter in the 1870s and claimed land ownership. In 1888, the Chilean government annexed Easter, which effectively became a sheep ranch managed by a Chile-based Scottish company. Grazing by the company's sheep, goats, and horses caused soil erosion and eliminated most of what had remained of the native vegetation. Not until 1966 did islanders become Chilean citizens. Today, islanders are undergoing a resurgence of cultural pride, and the economy is being stimulated by the arrival of several airplane flights each week, carrying visitors attracted by the famous statues. In part, because of this history of exploitation and oppression, there has been resistance among both islanders and scholars to acknowledging the reality of self-inflicted environmental damage, despite all the detailed evidence. We still have not faced the question why Easter Island ranks as such an extreme example of deforestation. After all, the Pacific encompasses thousands of inhabited islands, almost all of whose inhabitants were chopping down trees. Yet among all those islands, only three in the Hawaiian archipelago, all of them much drier than Easter, the two islets of Necker and Nioa, and the larger island of Niihau, even approach Easter in degree of deforestation. Nioa still supports one species of large palm tree, and it is uncertain whether tiny Necker, with an area of barely 40 acres, ever had trees. Why were Easter Islanders unique, or nearly so, in destroying every tree? Actually, it's just part of a broader puzzling question. Why degree of deforestation varies among Pacific islands in general? 9 physical variables contributed to the outcome. Most important were variations in rainfall and latitude. Dry islands and cooler islands further from the equator ended up more deforested than did wetter equatorial islands. The rate of plant growth and of seedling establishment increases with rainfall and with temperature. 3 other variables, island age, ash fallout, and dust fallout, had effects on soil fertility. Old islands that hadn't experienced any volcanic activity for over 1 million years ended up more deforested than young, recently active volcanic islands. That's because soil derived from fresh lava and ash contains nutrients that are necessary for plant growth, and that gradually become leached out by rain on older islands. One of the 2 main ways that those nutrients then become renewed is by fallout of ash carried in the air from volcanic explosions. But the Pacific Ocean is divided by a line famous to geologists known as the Andesite Line. In the Southwest Pacific, volcanoes blow out ash that may be wind-carried for hundreds of miles, and that maintains the fertility even of islands that have no volcanoes of their own. In the central and eastern Pacific, the main aerial input of nutrients to renew soil fertility is instead in dust carried high in the atmosphere by winds from the steppes of Central Asia. Islands east of the Andesite Line and far from Asia's dust plume ended up more deforested. Another variable required consideration only for 6 islands that consist of the rock known as Makatea, basically a coral reef thrust into the air by geological uplift. Makatea terrain is absolute hell to walk over. The deeply fissured, razor-sharp coral can slice up stout modern boots within a few days of walking. While Pacific Islanders somehow managed to get around on it in bare feet, even they had problems. Pacific islands with Makatea ended up less deforested than those without it. That leaves 3 variables with more complex effects: elevation, distance, and area. High islands tend to become less deforested even in their lowlands than low islands, because mountains generate clouds and rain which descends to the lowlands as streams, stimulating lowland plant growth by their water, by their transport of eroded nutrients, and by transport of atmospheric dust. Remote islands became more deforested than islands near neighbors, possibly because islanders were more likely to stay home and do things impacting their own environment. Big islands tended to become less deforested than small islands for numerous reasons, including lower perimeter area ratios, hence less marine resources per person and lower population densities, more centuries required to chop down the forest, and more areas unsuitable for gardening remaining. How does Easter rate according to these 9 variables predisposing to deforestation? Of 81 islands studied, It has the third highest latitude, among the lowest rainfalls, the lowest volcanic ash fallout, the lowest Asian dust fallout, no Makatea, and the second greatest distance from neighboring islands. It is among the lower and smaller of the islands studied. All those variables make Easter susceptible to deforestation. In short, the reason for Easter's unusually severe degree of deforestation isn't that those seemingly nice people really were unusually bad or improvident. Instead, they had the misfortune to be living in one of the most fragile environments of any Pacific people. Many centuries ago, immigrants came to a fertile land blessed with apparently inexhaustible natural resources. While the land lacked a few raw materials useful for industry, those materials were readily obtained by overseas trade with poorer lands that happened to have deposits of them. For a time, all the lands prospered, and their populations multiplied. But the population of the rich land eventually multiplied beyond the numbers that even its abundant resources could support. As its forests were felled and its soils eroded, its agricultural productivity was no longer sufficient to generate export surpluses, build ships, or even to nourish its own population. With that decline of trade, shortages of the imported raw materials developed. Civil war spread as established political institutions were overthrown by a kaleidoscopically changing succession of local military leaders. The starving populace survived by turning to cannibalism. Their former overseas trade partners met an even worse fate. Deprived of the imports on which they had depended, they in turn ravaged their own environments until no one was left alive. Does this grim scenario represent the future of the United States and our trade partners? We don't know yet, but the scenario has already played itself out on three tropical Pacific islands. One of them, Pitcairn Island, is famous as the uninhabited island to which the mutineers from the HMS Bounty fled in 1790. They chose Pitcairn because it was indeed uninhabited at that time, remote, and hence offered a hiding place from the British Navy. But the mutineers did find temple platforms, petroglyphs, and stone tools, giving mute evidence that Pitcairn had formerly supported an ancient Polynesian population. East of Pitcairn, an even more remote island named Henderson remains uninhabited to this day. Henderson, too, bears abundant marks of a former Polynesian population. What happened to those original Pitcairn Islanders and to their vanished cousins on Henderson? Basic information has at last emerged from recent excavations by Marshall Weisler, an archaeologist at the University of Otago in New Zealand, who spent 8 months on those lonely outposts. The fates of the first Pitcairners and the Henderson Islanders proved to have been linked to a slowly unfolding environmental catastrophe hundreds of miles overseas on their more populous island trading partner, Mongerava, whose population survived at the cost of a drastically lowered standard of living. Thus, just as Easter Island offered us our clearest example of a collapse due to human environmental impacts with a minimum of other complicating factors, Pitcairn and Henderson Islands furnish our clearest example of collapses triggered by the breakdown of an environmentally damaged trade partner, a preview of risks already developing today in association with modern globalization. Mongerava, Pitcairn, and Henderson are the sole habitable islands in the area known as Southeast Polynesia. They were settled sometime around AD 800 as part of the eastwards Polynesian expansion. Of those three habitable islands of Southeast Polynesia, the one capable of supporting by far the largest human population and most abundantly endowed with natural resources important to humans was Mongerava. It consists of a large lagoon 15 miles in diameter, sheltered by an outer reef, and containing 24 extinct volcanic islands and a few coral atolls with a total land area of 10 square miles. The lagoon, its reefs, and the ocean outside the lagoon teem with fish and shellfish. Especially valuable is the black-lipped pearl oyster, a very large oyster of which the lagoon offered virtually inexhaustible quantities to Polynesian settlers, and which is the species used today to raise the famous black cultured pearls. In addition to the oyster itself being edible, its thick shell, up to 8 inches long, was an ideal raw material that Polynesians carved into fish hooks, vegetable peelers and graters, and ornaments. The higher islands of Mangareva's lagoon received enough rain to have springs and intermittent streams and were originally forested. In the narrow band of flat land around the coasts, the Polynesian colonists built their settlements. On the slopes behind the villages, they grew crops such as sweet potato and yams. Terraced slopes and flats below the springs were planted in taro, irrigated by spring water, and higher elevations were planted in tree crops such as breadfruit and bananas. In this way, farming and fishing and gathering of shellfish would have been able to support a human population of several thousand on Mangareva, more than 10 times the likely combined populations of Pitcairn and Henderson. From a Polynesian perspective, Mangareva's most significant drawback was its lack of high-quality stone for making adzes and other stone tools. Fortunately, that deficiency was spectacularly remedied on Pitcairn, the much smaller and steeper extinct volcanic island, lying 300 miles southeast of Mangareva. Imagine the excitement when the first canoe load of Mangarevans discovered Pitcairn after several days' travel on open ocean, landed at its only feasible beach, scrambled up the steep slopes, and came upon Downrope Quarry, Southeast Polynesia's sole usable load of volcanic glass, whose flakes could serve as sharp tools for fine cutting tasks. Their excitement would have turned to ecstasy when, barely a mile along the coast, they discovered the Tautama load of fine-grained basalt, which became Southeast Polynesia's biggest quarry for making adzes. In other respects, Pitcairn offered much more limited opportunities than did Mangareva. It did have intermittent streams, and its forests included trees large enough to fashion into hulls of outrigger canoes. But Pitcairn's steepness and small area, only 2.5 square miles, meant that the area of level plateau suitable for agriculture was very small. An equally serious drawback is that the coastline lacks a reef, and the surrounding sea bottom falls off steeply, with the result that fishing and the search for shellfish are much less rewarding than on Mangareva. In particular, Pitcairn has no beds of those black-lipped pearl oysters so useful for eating and tool-making. Hence, the total population of Pitcairn in Polynesian times was probably not much greater than 100 people. The remaining habitable island of Southeast Polynesia, Henderson, is the largest at 14 square miles, but is also the most remote and the most marginal for human existence. Unlike Mangareva or Pitcairn, Henderson is not volcanic, but is in effect a coral reef that geological processes thrust up 100 feet above sea level. Hence, Henderson is devoid of basalt or other rock suitable for toolmaking. That's a severe limitation for a society of stone toolmakers. An additional severe limitation is that Henderson has no reliable freshwater sources. At best, for a few days after the unpredictable arrivals of rain, water drips from the roofs of caves, and puddles of water can be found on the ground. There is also a freshwater spring that bubbles up in the ocean about 20 feet offshore. Even soil on Henderson is confined to small pockets between the limestone. The island's tallest trees are only about 50 feet high, and not big enough to fashion into canoe hulls. The resulting stunted forest and thick undergrowth are so dense that they require a machete to penetrate them. Henderson's beaches are narrow and confined to the north end. Its south coast consists of vertical cliffs where it is impossible to land a boat. Offsetting these fearsome disadvantages, Henderson does have attractions. In the reef and shallow waters nearby live lobsters, crabs, octopus, and a limited variety of fish and shellfish, unfortunately not including black-lipped pearl oyster. On Henderson is Southeast Polynesia's sole known turtle nesting beach, where green turtles come ashore to lay eggs between January and March of each year. Henderson formerly supported at least 17 species of breeding seabirds, including petrel colonies possibly as large as millions of birds, whose adults and chicks would have been easy to catch on the nest. Enough for a population of 100 people, each to eat one bird every day of the year without endangering the colony's survival. The island was also home to 9 species of resident land birds, 5 of them flightless or weak flyers, and hence easy to catch, including 3 species of large pigeons that would have been especially delectable. All those features would have made Henderson a great place for a short vacation to glut yourself on seafood and birds and turtles, but a risky home in which to eke out a permanent existence. Excavations nevertheless showed that the island did support a permanent tiny population, possibly comprising a few dozen people that went to extreme effort in order to survive. Proof of their former presence is provided by 98 human bones and teeth, representing at least 10 adults, both men and women, some of them over 40 years old, 6 teenage boys and girls, and 4 children in the age range of 5 to 10 years. Further evidence of human use is a huge buried midden, one of the largest known from southeast Polynesia, running for 300 yards in length and 30 yards in width along the north coast beach, facing the only passage through Henderson's fringing reef. Where could people live on an island that is nothing more than an uplifted coral reef covered with low trees? There are only 3 signs of any construction: a stone pavement and post holes in the midden, suggesting the foundations of a house or shelter, 1 small low wall, and a few slabs of beach rock for a burial vault. Instead, literally every cave and rock shelter near the coast and with a flat floor and accessible opening contained debris, testifying to former human habitation. Marshall Weisler found 18 such shelters, which probably constitute all the dwellings of Henderson's population. The northeast part of the island had been burned and laboriously converted to garden patches, where crops could be planted in natural pockets of soil, extended by piling surface stones into mounds. Among the Polynesian crops and useful plants that were introduced intentionally by the settlers are coconuts, bananas, swamp taro, possibly taro itself, several species of timber trees, candlenut trees, whose nut husks are burned for illumination, hibiscus trees yielding fiber for making rope, and the tea shrub. The latter's sugary roots serve usually just as an emergency food supply elsewhere in Polynesia, but were evidently a staple vegetable food on Henderson. Most of the islanders' protein would have come from the wild birds and seafood, but finds of a couple of pig bones show that they kept or brought pigs, at least occasionally. Weisler's archaeological excavations uncovered extensive evidence of trade among all 3 islands, whereby each island's deficiencies were filled by the other island's surpluses. Numerous objects excavated at sites on Henderson could immediately be identified as imports because they were made from materials foreign to Henderson: oyster shell fish hooks and vegetable peelers, volcanic glass cutting tools, and basalt adzes and oven stones. Where did those imports come from? A reasonable guess is that the oyster shell for fish hooks came from Mangareva. A few oyster shell artifacts have also been found in Pitcairn and are similarly presumed to have come from Mangareva. All analyzed pieces of volcanic glass found on Henderson originated at the Down Rope Quarry on Pitcairn. Most of Henderson's basalt adzes also originated from Pitcairn, but some came from Mangareva. On Mangareva itself, some adzes were also evidently made from Pitcairn basalt, imported presumably because of its superiority to Mangareva's own basalt. As for what products Henderson exported to Pitcairn and Mangareva in return, we can only guess. One plausible candidate is live sea turtles, which were prized as a prestigious luxury food consumed mainly by chiefs. A second candidate is red feathers from Henderson's parrot, fruit dove, and red-tailed tropic bird, red feathers being another prestigious luxury item used for ornaments and feather cloaks. However, exchanges of raw materials, manufactured items, and luxuries would not have been the sole motive for transoceanic trade and travel. Even after Pitcairn's and Henderson's populations had grown to their maximum possible size, their numbers were so low that people of marriageable age would have found few potential partners on the island, and most of those partners would have been close relatives subject to incest taboos. Hence, exchanges of marriage partners would have been an additional important function of the trade with Mangareva. It would also have served to bring skilled craftspeople with technical skills from Mangareva's large population to Pitcairn and Henderson, and to re-import crops that by chance had died out in Pitcairn's and Henderson's small, cultivable areas. Trade within Southeast Polynesia continued from about AD 1000 to 1450, as gauged by artifacts and radiocarbon-dated archaeological layers on Henderson. But by 1500, the trade had stopped. Later archaeological layers on Henderson contained no more imported Mangareva oyster shell, no more Pitcairn volcanic glass. Apparently, the canoes were no longer arriving from either Mangareva or Pitcairn. Because trees on Henderson are too small to make canoes, Henderson's population of a few dozen was now trapped on one of the most remote, most daunting islands in the world. Henderson Islanders confronted a problem that seems insoluble to us. How to survive on a raised limestone reef without any metal, without stones other than limestone, and without imports of any type. They survived in ways that strike me as a mixture of ingenious, desperate, and pathetic. For the raw material of adzes, they turned to shells of giant clams. For awls to punch holes, they fell back on bird bones. They made their fish hooks out of purse shell, which is much smaller than black-lipped pearl oyster shell, so that it yields only one hook per shell and restricts the types of hooks that can be fashioned. Radiocarbon dates suggest that struggling on in this way, Henderson's population of a few dozen people survived for several generations, possibly a century or more, after all contact with Mangareva and Pitcairn was cut. But by AD 1606, the year of Henderson's discovery by Europeans, when a boat from a passing Spanish ship landed on the island and saw no one, Henderson's population had ceased to exist. Pitcairn's population had disappeared at least by 1790, the year when the Bounty mutineers arrived, and probably disappeared much earlier. Why did Henderson's contact with the outside world come to a halt? That outcome stemmed from disastrous environmental changes on Mangareva and Pitcairn. Mangareva was especially susceptible to deforestation for most of the reasons that I identified for Easter Island: high latitude, low ash and dust fallout, and so on. Habitat damage was extreme in Mangareva's hilly interior, most of which the islanders proceeded to deforest in order to plant their gardens. As a result, rain carried topsoil down the steep slopes, and the forest became replaced by a savanna of ferns. That soil erosion in the hills removed much of the area formerly available on Mangareva for gardening and tree crops. Deforestation indirectly reduced yields from fishing as well, because no trees large enough to build canoes remained. When Europeans discovered Mangareva in 1797, the islanders had no canoes, only rafts. With too many people and too little food, Mangareva society slid into a nightmare of civil war and chronic hunger, whose consequences are recalled in detail by modern islanders. For protein, people turned to cannibalism, in the form not only of eating freshly dead people, but also of digging up and eating buried corpses. Chronic fighting broke out over the precious remaining cultivable land. The winning side redistributed the land of the losers. Instead of an orderly political system based on hereditary chiefs, non-hereditary warriors took over. The thought of Lilliputian military dictatorships on eastern and western Mangareva, battling for control of an island only 5 miles long, could seem funny if it were not so tragic.